About a guy here, one. This Professor Amin Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University, Long Beach, Africana Studies Department. We want to welcome you here to the Conscious Corner and all our platform today during Black History Month. Former city councilman, I'm a former city councilman for the city of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees. Along with Brother Joe Hembrick that's on this evening. We happy to see that. He's a historian by his serious study and former administrator for the Linwood Unified School District, Compton Unified School District, counselor and student advocate. And at the same time, he's responsible for the Unity Mural of Black and Brown that's on Centennial High School. We want to welcome each and every one of you. We see Brother Matt Moore here, Sister Linda out of Florida, and Brother Ahi out of Detroit, and Brother Gerald Hill for the first time. I hope not be the last time, because he got a wealth of knowledge. He attended Cal State Long Beach in the days of activism, and he's a grant manager for the Department of Transportation, and we're happy to have him on. We're looking for Patrick Hall and a few other people to join us a little later. But what year were you there, Joe? I mean, Gerald?
I was there from 90 to 96.
90 to 96. Oh, yeah. Yeah, those were some good days.
Oh,
all
yeah.
Right. We're going to go ahead and get started. You know, this is, as we said, we're focusing on the Black movement at Cal State Long Beach by way of celebrating and recognizing Black History Month. That was started by Carter G. Woodson in February of 1926. A lot of people want to know how he chose February, because it was the birthdays of Frederick Douglass and Lincoln, I believe it was. And that's why he chose it. Second, there's a lot of efforts to close for the federal government not to recognize Black History Month, and they're taking it off of a lot of federal calendars. But Carter G. Woodson started Negro History Week, and he didn't ask the government. This was something that he pushed. And just like Kwanzaa, they didn't ask the government. Kwanzaa's a global activity now. And so Black History Month is a liberating and global activity. We don't care if they don't want to recognize it. We didn't ask them to. Matter of fact, the government's white anyway. You know, go celebrate white history. At the same time, that's why they call it the White House. You understand? I mean, for white folks, that's good. And we recognize that, because we just want to establish, as Carter G. Woodson's goal was, to establish the fact that we're part of the human family as an African people, and we made contributions before we came to America, made contributions once we got here, even in the Holocaust of enslavement, we was making contributions. And but at the same time, we was making contributions throughout history, from prehistory to ancient history to modern day history. And so we celebrated, because of the demonization that this society has put on us, as far as the relevancy of our history, why at the same time, through our experience in their education system, it was mandatory that we take their history, their version of history, his story, in other words, and accept it as a special truth, or the truth that's supposed to represent us. I mean, they had us thinking that we came over here on the Mayflower, as Malcolm would say, that we came, you know, they just excluded so much important information. But that's not it. We don't just focus on what they did to us. We focus on what we did for society, humanity, and ourselves. The creations, the innovations, the music, the dance, the spirituality, all those dynamics. We did some on the continent, some in other places, because of our diaspora being dispersed all over the world, you know, you can't take away, you can't take Jamaican history and act like that's not Black history. You can't take Haitian history and act like that's not Black history, because we're dealing with it from a racial perspective, and that's very important. So we look at that, and we look at history. We learn from its life lessons, the positives and the negatives. That's very important for us to get an understanding of it. And it's not just learning your history. It's using it as a resource to make you a better person. Let me explain that. A lot of people refer to Black history. Some even want to change it to Black Heritage Month. What's that about? You know, history is our record of our contributions to our development as a people, and our record of shaping the world into our image and interest, and our record of contributing to the betterment of the world as a whole. People benefit from our innovativeness. They benefit from the red light and stop light that Brother Morgan brought forth. They benefit from the open heart surgery of William Hale. They benefit from Lattimore's filament in the light bulb. They benefit from the potato chip. They benefit from all the other scientific invasions. The world have benefited from our contribution, but they want us just to focus on making them the center of our history by talking about what they did, where they enslaved you, and they did that. But in spite of all of that, we got out of it. It was supposed to be forever, but we got out. Our ancestors got out, and we built from that point on. And we become the top in their entertainment field. We become the top in their political field. We become the top in their music, music, sports, and whatever they did that they allowed us to participate in, we became excellent in. So we look at our history as our record. And from a racial standpoint, that means all Black people around the world. Is a part of our contribution. When we go and sit at the table of cultural contributions, we don't go up there and be naked. We bring forth all the innovative things that we did. And by way of recognizing Black History Month, we was focusing on our struggle to bring into being a new dynamic with regards to the African American movement, our Black movement, in America, and by way of recognizing the role of Haiti being the first independent Black country that set up its own sovereignty. And, you know, of course, the system backlashed on them, French and America boycotted embargoes, forcing them to pay reparations, like Lincoln proposed to pay the South. They did pay reparations to Southern enslavers, but they wouldn't give us reparations, and they still haven't. But that's a whole new different argument and discussion for another day. But we was focusing on Long Beach and Cal State Long Beach particularly, and it'd be wrong to say, and be a miscarriage of history to not credit the Black student movement at Cal State Long Beach and the Black community movement at Long Beach. A lot of people focus on Watts, a lot of people focus on Allentown, they focused on, the great migrations to Chicago, from Mississippi to Chicago and everywhere. But at the same time, you got to look at, well, you don't have to, but it's good to study our history because it's our record. That's our record. Everything have a history. Potato chips, ice cream. If you want to understand anything, you got to look at this history. And as Rasha Key always say, that Dr. John Henry Clark would always say, that to not know your history is like being a tree without roots. And so that's a very important perspective of us studying and recognizing and appreciation. That's what your birth certificate is about. That's what your grade cards is about. That's your record of your achievements in school. That's what your work ethic is about. That's what your children is about. They're all to maintain a historical record of your existence and remember you for the best you've been to them and to the society. So we look at history from a scientific perspective, not from an ideological heritage standpoint, but from a standpoint of how our record of making ourselves better and transforming. Not everybody participated. There's some people that have done different things, and some you would classify it as not really helpful to our community. But at the same time, oppression will make you do that. It'll make you look for alternative ways to make it. Half of the Europeans in this country, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, all of them had mafias. All of them had gangs. All of them came up robbing, stealing, and taking. And even the Columbus and the Pilgrims, all of them were gangbangers. You know, matter of fact, that's what Democrat and Republican mean, political gangbanger. What the Democrats are blue and the Republicans are red. That sounds like Crips and Bloods to me. I don't know about you. You know, you have religious gangbanging. You know what I mean? The imposition of pushing your religion on other people and demonizing them if they're not in your religion, killing them and forcing them and doing all kind of stuff. And the contradictions are over the top with regards to the father of Christianity, Catholicism. What's that about? Paying billions of dollars out for sexual assault on kids and then act and just sweep it under the door. Sweep it under the door. You understand? They're talking about sex trafficking. They don't have to go that far. All they have to go is to the Vatican. And they'll find a whole bunch of sex trafficking, and aborted babies by the nuns, all of those contradictions. But just because they abuse spirituality don't mean that spirituality didn't play a major role for us and a driving instrument for us, faith. And a vision for our future came inspired because of our spirituality, that if a dog running around is free, bumblebees are free, horses are free, what the hell am I doing in chains? And that inspired people, even though they tried to keep them ignorant, to long for freedom because they see animals, birds, everything flying around, and I'm a human. Even if the other people don't think I am who's enslaving me, but I see it, and that's why I work toward it. And that's how we got to where we are today. So we look at history as a very human thing. It gives us lessons to learn from, the positives and the negative, lessons of how to achieve, role models to emulate, and a blueprint to achieve. It's one thing to want to be something, and you got to know how to get there in the environment that we're in and what it takes. And at the same time, you have to always appreciate those that laid the footprints for you to follow to get to your goals. As Dr. Ben would say, the first person that got their college degree got it from someone that didn't have it. And so we look at the point is that a lot of that's commercial. It's like watching the Academy Award, white folks giving white folks awards saying, you're great. It's not like they're competing with the world cinema. This is them competing. They playing in the World Series, San Francisco against New York. That's not the world, you understand? But that's how they run their game. But anyway, getting back to our point, Cal State Long Beach Black Studies program was instrumental in keeping the movement going. It's one of the few institutions that still are maintained that were gains through struggle. And we gave that credit to the first BSU. And the first leader was Victor Brown and then Tony Wilkins. But they were hard line. And to not recognize their contribution to liberalizing that campus and getting significant gains in the short time that they operated. Remember, they just operated from 67 up to about 70, 71. And that's just 5 years. In 5 years, they established EOP, which was the gateway for many students to get in school. You know, they argued for that under the directorship of Joe White and his inspiration. And then Ernie Clark and Dewey and all the other directors, Don Duren and Freddie Jett, and a few other people that came after them. But at the same time, when they got EOP, what they struggled for was not just getting kids in school. They struggled for having the apparatus to admit students. When the first EOP program started, the EOP could admit at least 20% of their applicants. And that's how we got up to 1,700 students at Cal State Long Beach at one time. And they could admit them. Second, they played a role in the 70s by saying every student that came in through EOP had to take Black Studies or Ethnic Studies class. If you're Latino, you had to take a Latino class. If you're Asian American, you had to take at least 6 units. That was good. And plus, they gave grants in the beginning. Now they don't. It's strictly financial aid. They took away the power for them to admit students. And so, therefore, the enrollment went all the way down. And that's not by accident. That's not by accident. A good percentage of Blacks and Latinos and minorities being admitted in the mid-60s, all the way up to the 70s. And then all of a sudden, now you're down to, what, 7% Black. And then the shift in focus on Latinos, for the most part, whose numbers have expanded. But getting back to the point, after they did EOP, they got upward bound. They went into the community and worked with getting students acclimated to college, bringing them to the campus. I think Brother Johnson talked about one of his first experiences was to come through Upward Bound in the 70s. And visit the campus. That was a struggle for the BSU to be a part of that. But the monumental struggle was the establishment of a Black Studies department that was inspired by the overall Black movement across the country, but specifically in Long Beach. While we were doing things on campus, Long Beach was doing stuff in the community. Under the auspices of Ms. Ernest McBride, Frank Berry, and Jim Wilson, and Dale Clinton, and Ms. Knight, and a few other people. And there were centerpieces that people gathered to strategize. And one of them was Coleman Restaurant, and one place that was very instrumental, the Black House that was started in the 70s. And 555 PCH, the Long Beach Improvement League with Willie Martin, and the role of the Giles family with Willie Martin. And all these were families that really, that there was no refuge. Bill Barnes and all of them, some of them were moderates, and some of them were conservative Black, but they all were part of the movement and with different perspectives. But they contributed in some way by the whole city being in a movement toward Black liberation and expansion, leading to the Topsies and the Smiths to become city council, D. Andrews, the role of Long Beach Poly and Long Beach City College in sports, Blacks contributing to the making Long Beach on the map, because those were predominantly white institutions that Blacks took over Suffolk Poly, and then especially Long Beach City. That's why they have two campuses, one on PCH and one on Clark. And but at the same time, their sports excelled in basketball and football, and that helped. It brought people together, and it demonstrated excellence of Black athletes that went on to become pro athletes, and just achieved education and opportunity, and that's very important to recognize that, because some people think that they're the only Black people on the block, but that nobody had set the groundwork for them to even have the thoughts that they have. But it's always, as Mary McLeod, as Daniel Heyman said, never forget where you came from, and always praise the bridges that brought you over. And so we had recognized that. But anyway, one of the major establishments was the Black Studies Department. And that started, and then I'm gonna open it up for questions and comments. That started in 1967, 68, the proposal. It came to fruition in 1969. Now, actually, there was a class being offered by Clyde Taylor and Dr. Lindsay Thomas in Black literature before Black study classes were. They were starting the African American literature class. I don't know if anybody attended it, and I don't know if it ever got started, but they did propose it, and it was approved to be offered. But then in 69 was the opening of the first Black Studies Department, and a brother named Arthur Jackson, I think his name was, he was selected as a chair of the Black Studies program. The students had they had to have a what they call an ad hoc hiring committee, because they didn't have nobody established. And the students, and that was mainly the BSU advisory committee, I mean, leadership. They were also the advisory committee with awesome power in Black studies. And so they chose this dude, Jackson, but he never came. He signed the contract. And then when it's time for him to come and be the chair of the program, he didn't come. So the BSU at that time selected Tony Wilkins, who was the president of the BSU, to be the acting chair. But he hadn't graduated, he was still a junior. And so many of the faculty rebelled and the administration rebelled because they wouldn't recognize none of the paperwork he sent up, and they didn't honor him as a chair, even though the BSU did. And they were planning on demonstrating and making him the chair, regardless of what the administration was saying. So the administration closed Black Studies down in 1970, the summer of 70. Closed it down, changed the locks on all the offices, would not pay the faculty under the auspices of that they didn't do their evaluations, their annual evaluation, all faculty, probationary faculty had to do. Now, I want you to understand, when we started, I was a student that helped start it. I was in the BSU and I was a part of that. And I sat in some of the curriculum committees. What happened was that none of the Black faculty that was on campus would come and teach in Black studies. None of the doctors, not Dr. June Cooper, not Dr. Anatole, not Dr. Tillman, none of the Black professors, even the sister, Miss Williams, Ora Williams, she wouldn't even teach. None of them, because they thought that it would take away from them being in the discipline that they were hired. Fillmore Freeman, Lindsay Thomas, even Clyde Taylor left in 69. I mean, he inspired the BSU and inspired Black students, and then he left. Joe White left in 68. And so therefore, you know, all the strong Black faculty was not there. And a lot of them didn't want to work with the BSU because they felt that they were too radical, and you know, and their demands, because they were so progressive. They ran off. I think there was four college presidents that had to leave before the reconstitution of Black studies. They couldn't stand the heat. That's how much they were struggling at Cal State Long. I mean, whoo, man, they had special space in the 49er store where they could sell things. They had special places in the library to get Black books. They had, I mean, these were hard line demands, you see, that went with the establishment of a department, not a program. Remember, San Francisco State is credited with starting the first Black study department. That wasn't a department, that was a program. Cal State LA and Cal State Northridge at that time, and San Fernando, I forget, all the Cal State systems began to start Black studies programs, and they demonstrated. Black athletes revolted in 68, along with Harry Edwards, Kareem Jabbar, and all of them. So Black athletes were rebelling on white dominant campuses, wearing Black gloves, not standing for the Star Spangled Banner. You know, I mean, it was a trip. I mean, they start playing the music, the Star Spangled Banner, you know, at every game, and brothers and sisters just sat down. So it was very hard line. But anyway, getting back to Black study. And so I was an athlete, and I was very active in the movement. We started the Black Athletic Association along with Martin Veal and David Mead and a few other people, and all the athletes, all the Black athletes down there, as an offshoot of the BSU, to work with them and be a part of them. We started the first soul concert, and we took students on trips to Watson, Compton, just to let them see the Black community. A lot of Black people had never been into a predominantly Black community. Some of them came to middle class, but we took them through there, all the way up to Vernon and L.A., where we went to Bill's Taco House, and all that was Santa Barbara at that time. It was Martin Luther King Boulevard. And then with the projects, took them to Nicholson Garden, took them to Imperial Court, and you know, on a field trip, took them to the Watchtower, and this was way before Martin Luther King Hospital, and just took them to Palm Lane, and all those places in Watson County. But anyway, they wanted to make me a Jerry Tarkanian, George Demo, told Stephen Horn once he got the job that he needed to meet me and they needed to get me a job. I was finishing up as a varsity basketball player, and I was very instrumental on campus and keeping peace and keeping things going. So they had me come and meet with Stephen Horn. And Stephen Horn them offered me a job in athletics. I said I didn't want that. I said I wanted to reopen Black Studies because they had shut it down and locked it down, you know. And so they needed an outlet, and they knew that I had a paramilitary group behind me with regards to Black athletes and Black students, because I was heavily followed as a leader. So they let me do it. So I became the first head of Black Studies of the reconstituted Black Studies Department in 1970. The other one never really had a head, even though they offered classes in 69. And Jackson and Clyde Taylor them set them up. And then after that 69, the fall and spring semester, that summer is when all chaos came in. And there was a lot of reasons for the chaos. It's not just Tony Wilkins being a student trying to be a chair of academic discipline. It was also some infighting in the BSU, and for a lot of different reasons. I'll get into that later. And so I took over, and I went and met with the BSU. I said, look, we got Black Studies back started. I met with their leadership. I said, listen, y'all run it. Because I got the newspaper article where I said, we're going to hire everybody back The same people you have hired. They had hired John Calloway, who didn't have a degree. They had hired Emory Evans, who didn't have a degree. They had hired most of the people in there only had BAs. And I said, we're going to bring them back. Y'all can run it. I just wanted to get it back open. But the BSU leadership, just their leadership, rejected that. They said, no, we got our own plan. I said, look, man, whatever your plan is, you can integrate them with mine. Yeah, no, we're going to do our own thing. This was just a click, the leadership. And so I said, okay, I'm just going to run it. So I just left and ran it, you understand? And we doubled enrollment, rolled our first certificate program. And they left campus for two reasons. One, they had split over infighting and internal fighting. Second, that Dr. Barbara George, who's a black lady, became dean of the business department. Their office was in the business department, and she put them out of their office without another office being offered. So I let them come over to Black Studies to open up an office. But anyway, Tony, I mean, they said, we're going to go off campus and work from the Black House. So they left campus. So we had a void with regard to Black activism. And so the Black Studies Department started the Black Studies Student Association under Jeffrey Lakes and Darrington Sampson. And they became very active along with Sidney Lee and J.P. Marsh, Sheila Ringer, and a few other sisters. And they became the most active and most progressive organization on campus, advocate for students. See, BSU means Black Student Union. Just like the AFL-CIO is a union, you're supposed to represent the students for financial aid, help them with their services, find tutoring programs, you know, just help get students in school and help fight for student rights on campus, because they were limited there. They couldn't even rent apartments around the campus when we first came there. You know, they matter of fact, they had a group of civil rights workers that went and sent black people to try to rent an apartment. They said they had vacancy on the outside. And when they got in, they said, oh, we rented it. Then they sent a white person there. They said, oh, yeah, it's available. And they did that in Long Beach. Second, the Ku Klux Klan met right down there at Little Rec in Long Beach, across from Big Rec. And, you know, you got to remember, Long Beach is on the, is right on the edge of Orange County. And Orange County was known for John Birch societies and racism at that time. But anyway, so we started Black Studies. Number of the faculty came back. Couldn't get nobody with a PhD to teach in it. Nobody. I think one African brother named Della Lucy, he may have been one. Oconee only had a BA, and he left and went to Santa Barbara, got his master's and PhD. Charlie Jeffers had a master's. And most of the people that were working there were, when we were talking about bringing them back, they were all affiliated with either a faculty member or dating one of the BSU students that became a part of the faculty. And that's really, you can check it, you know. And so I said, bring them all back. But some of them didn't want to come back because of their loyalty to the BSU leadership. And some did come back. Emory Evans worked for 3 years with no degree at all. I kept him working. And we brought in new people who took the place of those that didn't come back. Oconee stayed for a year, and Bernita Sims and Miss Anatole, who was married to Dr. Anatole, and her and Bernita and Miss Jeffries, they all taught language skills. See, the beautiful thing about the BSU, when they started Black Studies, a student can get 36 GE requirements out the way. 36 units of GE out the way. They can get literature, they can get language skills, which took the place of English one. They could get a history. All these classes counted towards your GE. A political science, black men in politics, or black people, or black politics, black economics, all of that. They had a beautiful curriculum. And we all did. We all participated in it and got it accredited with approval to give students GE credit. GE credit is general education credit. When you go to college, you graduate from three areas. First of all, your GEs, general ed. Second, your major. And third, your overall requirements for graduation. In other words, 124 units and a C average. That's the overall. You had to meet your requirements of your department and your GE requirement. Then you had upper division GE. And so we started a minor certificate program, doubled the enrollment, and the rest is history from that standpoint. A lot of people put a lot of negative things out there, but the Black Studies Department was instrumental in the community. We took the college to the community. We fought for the Roland Peterson case. We fought for Tony Wilkins, who was assassinated at the Rose Bowl. We fought for Bobby Smith, who was shot by the Highway Patrol. We fought for Ron Settles. We fought for Annette Cannoli. I think Ginger remember that. Annette Cannoli gave, I think, 5 cents more change than they wanted to fire from the bookstore. And we turned that around. And we just became one of the blackest departments in the Cal State system. And so that's how I became the head of Black Studies for 3 years. And then when they found out that they couldn't tell me what to do, they developed a scheme to replace me as chair. Now I was putting in close to sun up to sun down at the department because I had to learn how to be a professor and learn how to manipulate through that institution called the university. All the committees you had to go to, the curriculum committee, the academic senate. And so it was a year of learning for me. And so I learned all those things, but we were able, I mean, it was just a beautiful, beautiful episode. But I'm gonna go ahead and get y'all response to some of these things. Gerald, are you still there? Okay. Brother Matt?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that, you know, I was wondering, my granddaughter just enrolled in Black Studies out there, a winter program now. She'd be got accepted by the dean. She's trying to work a scholarship to enroll at Long Beach in the fall. But,
okay.
You know, you mentioned a lot of these about, because I just gave a talk to the National Negroes Council, National Women's Negro Council Saturday, you know, about Long Beach. Because, you know, back in 23, this used to be a Ku Klux Klan stronghold, Long Beach.
Yeah.
And back when my mom came in 23, they was arresting black guys. You know, you come to town as a black man, they say, you have a job? You say a no, then they arrest you for vagrancy. And then you go before the judge and he said, well, a $10 fine. You said, well, I don't have no $10, John, I don't work. So they put you, it was a farm, a lot of farming communities right around in Santa Ana and Fullerton and, you know, and out in Paramount even. They put them out to the dairy and you work 5 days. That was another form of slavery, to, you know, to pay off that fine. But so, and that's what made my dad so instrumental in fighting that. They had a big parade, I think it was 1928, where they had, the Klan had a big parade down Ocean Avenue to Rec Park, and they had a cadre of police officers leading the parade, maybe about 30 or 40 of them. And then behind them, they got this Klansman, and his, you know, he's unmasked, got his Halloween hat on there, and he's carrying an American flag. And then behind him, there must have been about 64 abreast, about 60 Ku Klux Klan members dressed in full robe, but all of them were masked. And they boasted that they had like 15,000 strong here in Long Beach. And the police force was just about all Klan members. And so you had to fight that. My dad, a lot of years fighting them, trying to get rid of that. And so we are, you mentioned Clark, you know, Ernie Clark, that's my, his grandfather was married to my grandmother. So we were kind of related. And Willie Martin is my brother-in-law right now. And then Dee Andrews and Willie and I, we played on Junior Rose Bowl team in 1960 in Long Beach City. So a lot of things like that did kind of slowly loosen up. But, you know, like in the 60s there, you couldn't, in 50s, you couldn't find, there was only two places you, black person could eat in Long Beach. And one of them was Cress's department store, which was on Pine at the counter. You know, it was like a sandwich shop. It was a clothing store. And then our drugstore. And then my grandfather, who was Martinville's dad, he worked at our drugstore on Long, it was American Avenue then, but it was Long Beach Boulevard now on 3rd Street. They had a, on the south east corner, they had a owl drugstore there. And you could go in there and eat blacks, but you know, nowhere else you could eat in the city until the NAACP started breaking all that up. Because whenever they found a place that was racial, they put up a picket line and march, and until they either break the people or they hired somebody. So that's how they got the first black police officer hired. But it, you know, they started that in 1943, and it took them to 48 to get a black person on the police force. And then, so then you, you know, and like you say, all every little bit helps. The black student thing helped, and the black Muslims, you know, when we had the kind of semi-militant groups with that, kind of made things, that helped turn things around. You know, we still fighting the fight, but, you know, cause like my dad said, hey, you're going to be fighting the same fight I'm fighting. And then now I'm kind of putting it on my granddaughter where she's coming along. And, you know, we have to do what we have to do to keep things going. So, and it's trying to loosen it up. So we got the first black police officer, and then the fire department got a black in there. And then my dad protested with the city, going down there talking to them. So you need to hire, you know, blacks for more than just shoe shining jobs, and got them on the sanitation department. So that kind of broke that open. And then once things started to flow, and you know, my older sister, General Telephone Company, Verizon bought them out, but they didn't have any black clerk typists working for them. And so dad went on and talked to them. They said, well, we don't have anybody qualified. So my dad told my older sister, said, you go down there, you got any friends that can type? And she said, yeah, took a girl down there. And then my dad said, well, you go down there and witness the test and see what, make sure that, because they pull stuff on you on the test. You could pass a test, and then they would say, well, your hair wasn't right, or any kind of excuse, your blood wasn't right, and prevent, you know, to try to stop you from getting higher. And my sister went with, and her friend, they said, when she went down there, she said, well, I'm here representing the NAACP to witness tests. And the people say, well, you can't do that. You, if you're going to be in there witness, you have to take it too. So she took it, and her friend took it. And my sister passed, and her friend didn't. So my dad said, oh, you know, you're going, we're going, because we need to integrate that place. So you got to hire in. And she said, I'm not doing that. I got a waitress job at Arnold's restaurant in Maywood Bell, and I'm making like a $1.15 an hour then, and this job is only paying like $1.05. And so my dad, because he was an auto mechanic, fixed everything, and an electrician, he'd always fix her car. And he kind of bribed it because he said, well, if you don't hire in, I'm not going to fix your car. You're going to have to go down to Mr. Hayes. That was a black auto mechanic. So my sister quit that job, went to the telephone company, hired in. He told us, so you can just work 2 or 3 months till we can get it opened up. And then another one of my friends, John Atkinson, lefty, where his sister came down there and hired in. And my sister quit, went back to the Arnold's restaurant in Maywood, but they said, we don't have no more jobs here, but we got something open in Belmont Shore. So she went down to Belmont Shore. So that's kind of a small little thing that happened, you know.
Well, first of all, Ernest, I did talk to Carl this morning.
Yeah, because they had the minstrel shows here in Long Beach Unified School District. Would use that to raise funds. That was my first experience with the black movement, kind of was walking picket lines for him.
So. But hold that point right there. I'm going to get to Gerald. Are you still there? What year were you in outstate? And tell us about you. And I'm going to come back to you, Matt.
All right.
Gerald, what was your years you was there? And what do you find interesting at Cal State Long Beach that contributed to your consciousness today?
Okay, well, I was there from 1990 to 1996. And I think, I don't want to brag about it, but I think we probably have, other than maybe during the foundation of the Black Studies department, like, I think we really had, like, it going on. Like, activism was at an all-time high during that time. And we was really, a lot of the students on campus was really engaged in a lot of the protests, particularly fighting against like Ward Connolly and the Proposition 187 and the 209, the Civil Rights Amendment that he tried to lie and say that it was protecting civil rights when it was doing the opposite. Our Black Studies Department and our consciousness conferences, I think at that point, we worked so tight with all of the gains that kind of happened that you described earlier, where we get these accredited classes that you said 36 units. That was 36 units that you could take in the Black Studies Department, get you a great education, and be able to get your degree in whatever you want to get it in. And I really think that that to me made Long Beach special because it was the blackest white college ever. I mean, I'd say that the consciousness and the education that we received there was definitely more, like, I'd say impactful than if I went to Howard or Morehouse or wherever. You know, it just, you couldn't get it like that. And it was, I think the best part about it was tailor-made from California kids at a great migration, kids that understood what it is to get pulled over by the police, you know, just mind your own business. Well, y'all taught us what to do, what to say, what not to say, how to avoid situations, how to talk your way out of stuff, like just all of that other stuff that, you know, you just can't get normally is where, like, all of our professors gave us that. And y'all made us feel a lot of love that we belong there. That regardless, I remember you said something one time. You said, all these professors here is trying to flunk y'all out of school. He said, if they would have had campus out here on the yard, I had class out here and I passed everybody. So I'm saying that's the kind of people that you need in your corner. Especially at that age, you 18 to 24. Come on now, like, you don't know who you are, and that's really the time where people come in their own and being like a person, a man or a woman. And so to have those type of people around you to support you, that give you encouragement, that give you gentle correction, all of that kind of stuff was, to me, like, that was invaluable. And I love that I got that experience.
Well, thanks, Gerald. And we appreciate your achievements, too, living in Washington, D.C. over 20 years now and having a family and taking that Black experience there, because I know you're keeping it real, and we appreciate it.
Absolutely.
That. Brother Matt?
Oh, no.
Your experiences at Cal State. Matt Moore, you're on mute. Can you get it off? You must be on your phone. Okay, Jin Jay, while he's working to get his mute off, you there, Jin Jay? Now, you know you were one of the main leaders of all the noise with the sisters. BSU. What do you take away from that history of Long Beach State?
Oh, it's so inspiring. It set the standard of my life. Mm-hmm. I remember the programs that we used to put together. Tribute to the Black Man. Oh my goodness.
Oh boy.
We did some great programs, and you have it all on film. You know, we need to really get that together because it's so historic. I see that Fareed was
with us, and he'll probably come back.
Mm-hmm. And the name changing ceremony, significant. Mm-hmm. The name changing ceremony that we participated with really set the standard, you know, on the heels of Irving Hirst making his transition. It truly inspired me, and I'm sure a lot of other brothers and sisters. It just set standards for my life personally. I don't know if I ever told you, Amin-Ra, that my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was a Garveyite. He was born in Barbados, and then I ended up with a Jamaican, so it was real real spiritual trip. Making those connections, because prior to attending Long Beach State, I wasn't even in tune to the fact that I had family members that were followers of the Most Honorable Marcus Garvey.
Yeah, well, I'm glad they pardoned him, Biden. Mm-hmm. He wanted
Obama.
Barack to do it, but he wouldn't do it, but Biden did pardon him. But answer me a question, Ginger. What made you get active on campus? I mean, you came there, and you know, and then all of a sudden you just took off.
Well, my first class was, I believe, psychology of the Black athlete. Mm-hmm. You were teaching it.
Exploitation of the Black athlete.
Yes, exploitation of the Black athlete. Yes, that was my first class. And from that, I was so inspired that I met Mashariki, and I believe she's logged on now. Yes, and we just continued. I think, you know, attending Long Beach State, being there in a predominantly white society, it just felt home to be amongst ourselves. And I remember you had just attended the State of the Race Conference, and you were on fire, boy. Yes, you were on fire, and I caught it. You were hot, and I caught it. Yeah. And it's still to this day. I remember that. And so that's what made me be a part. And it was just significant that, you know, at that time there was so much happening in our community, in our society, that we had to organize. You know, it's so unfortunate that these young people now don't have the fire, or maybe they do and I just don't know, but they just so settled on the sacrifices that were made prior to them. They never took part of the fight.
Yeah.
So they can't appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. When you don't fight for something, it's hard to appreciate what you have. But you were very instrumental as a BSU president and as a person to not just be conscious yourself, but to help others come into consciousness. You and my Shariki Rose, the Sisters of the Revolution movement that y'all, that Rose them started. I don't know if you were part of it, but it was a lot of strong Black women that were part of the BSU and became BSU president. And they tell you, they were the heart of Niner, and they kept the organization going. We deeply
appreciate it. And not to mention it, we were some fine young sisters at that time. We had it in our brains, and I mean, I remember we were like about size 9 about that time, you know, give you a visual. And we were really about it. You know, Mashriki used to take them pictures. She always had her camera, and we'll break out in a song any minute. The greatest love of all, she would just break out in song. It was inspired.
Yeah. Okay. Brother Matmore.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Yeah, I'm sorry about the mute problem. I'm just sitting here writing, taking notes, and you know, this history of first BSU and a lot of things that took place. I came there in 1977, so I was there from 1977 to 1982. But when I came, I think I mentioned it before that growing up in LA and Black Panther Party was up on Central Avenue where my family's home is still. So being exposed to Black Panthers and coming to Long Beach, one of the most, I think, challenging thing was, and I think I mentioned the first time we had the Conscious Corner discussion, was Dr. Walter Reed, was the brother that I met, because I ended up on academic probation. Basically saved me. And I'm not just one. I mean, I'm pretty sure there's thousands of others that he was able to help, because once, you know, you ended up on academic probation, they give you a semester to get it right if you were out. And of course, I was taking classes with you, and I remember Dr. Beatty Sanzalo and a lot of other Black study professors. But Dr. Walter Reed helped me learn how to study. Coming from Thomas Jefferson High School down in South Central, you know, I was being told that no people from my neighborhood, and they labeled me basically because I came from a ghetto school and said that I wasn't going to make it. So I was determined to prove them wrong, you know, that just because I'm from South Central has nothing to do with, you know, my ability. So, but Dr. Walter Reed was the person who got me on the straight and narrow and helped me with my studies in order to basically stay in school, and went on to be on the dean's list and eventually the president's list and graduating top of my class. But I always give much praise to Dr. Walter Reed for that.
Dr. Walter Reed came as a director of affirmative action.
Is that right?
And his job was to teach the college. He went there and he started advocating for Black and Latinos inclusion in the libraries and pointed out discrimination on the campus, and they fired him. Because his job was, when they hired an affirmative action person, his job was to teach the college how to get around the laws, you know? And he broke that. And we gave him retreat. I mentioned to him about retreat rights. And that meant that when he first came and signed his contract, he didn't get his retreat rights. Okay. And that means that you come in as an administrator, you're supposed to be granted a faculty position in a department so that you can fall back on it, because you only hire year by year as an administrator. on campus. And department chairs, the reason they appointed me administrator was because department chairs had to be elected by the faculty on a national search to be a department chair. So they hired me as administrator of Black Studies, an appointed position. And then the same thing with Walter Reed. That's how he got his counseling position. And it turned out beautiful because he became one of the most popular and strong counselors there advocating for students, Matt. You brought that up. Sister Mashariki.
Oh, let's see if I can come in.
Yeah, we hear you.
Oh, you can hear me. Oh, okay, yeah. Wait a minute.
Now, you were very instrumental in inspiring so many people, not just through your actions, but you was a hardliner, one of the hardliners. And people had so much respect for you and your contributions to the movement. I mean, you can't, the era that you was there, it's hard for people to say that they didn't know you because you were known all over the campus. But go ahead, Mashariki. What years were you there?
I was there from 74 to maybe about 79, 80. We were calling it Cal State Disneyland because it was like so many things to be involved in. Once you get there, you're supposed to be focused and get in and get out. But I was just overwhelmed with being around people like myself, Black people, even though it was a Black university within a white university. You as a teacher, the things that you shared with us, the consciousness conference, all the different friends that I made, the fact that we were pretty much like a big family. You know, we had lots of potlucks. We did a lot of eating, dancing, laughing, and having a good time. So, and doing serious things too. A lot of things, you know, it made me a stronger person. Coming from the Bay Area, I guess I was kind of hard on some things because I didn't tolerate disrespect of Black men. There were some situations that came up. I was like, all we have is each other. We cannot afford to throw anybody under the bus for whatever selfish whims it may be. So, yeah, I really enjoyed, and I wish I could go back to that time. The real world is pretty challenging now with the things that are happening today.
Well, the struggle continues. One of the hardest things that you will find, and Machenda can attest to this because he's in the Deep South, he's on. Gerald can attest to this because he's in D.C. where a lot of African people and Black people are. I say that because there's a lot of diaspora and Africans in D.C. It's hard to get a cab and not be in with a brother from the continent. But brother, it's a stay Black. Because this society will overwhelm you. To stay conscious and to stay active in some way, in some form, it's hard. Now, you can branch off into various professions, maybe, you know, helping your children, being magicians or doing things. But keeping your consciousness is a struggle. So to stay steadfast. And that's why you build institutions to continue. It's like you have children to continue your legacy. You build institutions to continue your legacy and our atmosphere. The system tries to tear them down, break them down, where you can't duplicate that struggle. Then they try to crack back on you. Like they took away a lot of the power of EOP. They diminished the powers of student involvement in Black studies and in Africana studies right now. And they do things to, just like what they did to Haiti. Haiti got its freedom, but then they put blockades all around Haiti and forced them to pay reparations to the French for getting freedom from the French and still doing it. And you know, so it's just hard to stay Black in a white dominant society because they put so much on you, cost of food, cost of this, cost of that. And then, you know, then you lose soldiers on the way. You have casualties, people die, people have strokes, people get sick, people, get old, people get diabetes, and you know, they just get tired. But you got to have faith. You got to have Imani. Brother Brian Wilson, you there? What about Mashinda? Mashinda, you there? Well, listen, Roshki? Roshki, we're going to continue this again next Tuesday. We're going to go all the way up to the 80s and all the demonstrations and the things that the BSU did to save jobs, because they were trying to close Black Studies down year after year. If it don't be for Brother Fareed, Brother Charles Walker, and Brother Jerry Davis, Lasar, and all the BSU presidents. What made me strong and they couldn't move on me was the power that I had with the students. You know, the students kept me there. Because they showed they wanted to get rid of me. They even hired Black people to offer me positions off campus. And things of this nature as well as try to come up with all kinds of excuses. First they said, you give too many aid. And I said, yeah. And I said, but the psychology department give more aids than me as a whole. I mean, they doubled, all the faculty gave aid. And the same thing with sociology, but they were to all white people. You understand? So because I give my people reparations, you understand? Keep them in school. You was giving all the athletes good grades just to be eligible to play football and basketball. But so why can't I give them good grades to keep them in school so they can mature and realize where they are and get started? I mean, once I saw the game, it was on. You understand? It's about love and caring for your people and realizing that 40% of the school was on academic probation.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that mean we only represented what at that time? What, about 10%? And so that means that wasn't all of us. But anyway, that's where this brother, Rashid, bring us on in. And we're going to be back here next week. Hope all y'all will tune in and get others to come in. And if you have a issue that you want to discuss, leave your phone number in the chat and so we can contact you and your email. And then if you need my number, it's 310-505-2358. 310-505. This is a platform to do it. Media as a way of business. Rashiki.
Okay, can everybody hear me?
You there?
Are you guys able to hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. The video was, my connection is unstable. I don't know why. But tomorrow we have the Level Set crew coming on. They are some guys out of New York, not New York, but St. Louis and Chicago area. And they have an excellent podcast on Saturday mornings. It's just a recording, but I mean, I've been enjoying their commentary for over a year now. And plus, we're affiliated. They're affiliated with us. So they're going to come on tomorrow, and they're going to interview one of their panelists, Mike Jones. He's a political columnist out of St. Louis. So it should be very interesting. If you can make it, that'll be good. And if not, you can check it out on YouTube or the website. Community Education Network. This is the website here. And you have the podcast and you have the audios. You have all the audios from the previous shows. And I don't see it. I don't know why I don't see it, but oh, here they are. So there you go. So you can always catch the shows if you're not able to attend. Appreciate everybody coming out. And we're doing this all the time. So, like Professor Ross said, if you're interested in being a guest on the show, just contact Professor Ross, Barry Thomas, me or Jin J, you know, we all are connected. So we're going to take our pause. Each one, and Conscious Corner.
All right, then. Hey.